Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome one and all to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Every month we extend happy birthday wishes to a different film that's currently observing a joyous jubilee. We count that as anything from a 20th all the way up to a 100th anniversary. This, as ever, is your devoted host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse film discussion group. And if you have just found our show, welcome. If you are a regular listener, we're thrilled you're back. Some comedies bubble to the surface and satiate the funny bone for a finite period before fizzling out, right? Other laughers transcend time and can evoke side-splitting snickers whenever they're played. And then there are funny flicks that take it to the highest level, works of such hilarity and humorous genius that they've earned a place in the pantheon of all-time comedies. Duck Soup, widely regarded as the Marx Brothers' magnum opus, is certainly one of these. Starring the silly sibling team of Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo, and chock full of bullseye jokes, zany mayhem, cartoonishly clever bits, witty wordplay, and supreme slapstick, Duck Soup endures as a national cinematic treasure 9 decades later. To honor this film's 90th birthday, I'll be joined in this installment by Robert Bader, director of the documentary Groucho and Cabot, and author of 4 of the 3 Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on Stage. Together we will discuss how and why Duck Soup remains so funny, ways it has stood the test of time, the influence this work has had on comedy in all media, and much, much more. But let's not put the cart before the horse, or the horse feathers, if you will. Take a moment with me now and let's learn a bit more about how Duck Soup came to be. Wikipedia reports that Duck Soup is a 1933 American pre-code musical comedy film written by Burt Kalmer and Harry Ruby, with additional dialogue by Arthur Sheikman and Nat Perrin, and directed by Leo McCary. Released theatrically by Paramount Pictures on November 17, 1933, Duck Soup starred the Marx Brothers, Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Zeppo in his final Marx Brothers movie, and also featured Margaret Dumont, Louis Calhern, Raquel Torres, and Edgar Kennedy. It was the last of 5 Marx Brothers movies released by Paramount Pictures. In the film, Groucho portrays the newly installed president of the mythical country of Fredonia. Zeppo is his secretary, while Chico and Harpo are spies for the neighboring country of Sylvania. The plot depicts how relations between Groucho and the Sylvanian ambassador deteriorate during the film, with the two sides going to war at the conclusion. Now, bitter contract disputes, including a threatened boycott by the Marx Brothers, soured their negotiations with Paramount just as Duck Soup went into production. After the film fulfilled their 5-picture obligation to the studio, the Marxes and Paramount agreed to part ways. While contemporaneous critics of Duck Soup felt it, did not quite rise to the level of its predecessors, critical opinion has taken a turn over the decades, and the film has since achieved the status of an all-time classic. In 1990, the United States Library of Congress deemed Duck Soup culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, and it selected it for preservation in the National Film Registry. A few years back, the American Film Institute ranked Duck Soup number 5 on its list of the 100 funniest American films of all time. And if you head on over to Rotten Tomatoes right now, you'll see that Duck Soup gets a 91% fresh rating and an average critical score of 9.1 out of 10, along with an audience score of the same 91%. What say we tickle our eardrums with a taste of the original Duck Soup trailer?
Thank you. Your Excellency, I must speak to you.
I'll see you at the theater tonight. I'll hold your seat till you get there. After you get there, you're on your own.
Hello? Hello, yes? No, he's not in yet. All right, but goodbye. That was for you again.
I wonder whatever became of me. I should have been back here a long time ago.
They got guns. We got guns. All got children got guns.
Okay, with a hey, nah, nah, nee, and a ha-cha-cha, let's welcome this month's guest. He's considered one of the foremost historians and researchers on the Marx Brothers, and he's also the author of and contributor to several books about Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and their siblings, including Four of the Three Musketeers, the Marx Brothers on Stage, Speaking of Harpo, and Groucho Marx and Other Short Stories and Tall Tales. Paired with Leonard Maltin, he also provided a feature commentary track for Duck Soup in the Marx Brothers Silver Screen Collection box set, released just a few years ago. He's Robert Bader, and we are delighted to welcome him to the Cineversary microphone. How are you, Robert?
Well, thank you, Eric. It's nice to be here with you, and it's quite a thing to be the Marx Brothers historian. Well, I wonder what that pays.
Hopefully well, but it could be a labor of love on some
it
extent.
It really and truly is.
I'm sure. Hey, 90th anniversary of what many consider to be the Marx's finest hour. And it is roughly an hour. It's only about 68 minutes. You don't necessarily have to agree. So my first question to you, why do you think Duck Soup is deserving of high praise 90 years later? And can you recall the first time you watched this movie and your initial reaction?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to start with the first time I saw Duck Soup. I remember I grew up in New York City, and in the late 60s and early 70s, mm-hmm. Channel 5 in New York used to run all of the old Paramount comedies, not just the Marx Brothers, but W.C. Fields. They would run Burns and Allen. All the classic stuff that we know from the early 30s mm-hmm. would be running on Saturday mornings on Channel 5 in New York. And I first discovered the Marx Brothers just, flipping around the channels, and there they are. And I didn't know who they were, and I started watching. That movie turned out to be Monkey Business, my first exposure.
And how old were you? Do you recall?
When I saw Monkey Business, I think I was about 8, maybe 9.
Okay, that was about me. I don't know. There's something about that age. Not that we're a huge sample size, but that's about the age I was turned on to the Marx Brothers.
Well, what struck me later when I started to really think about it, and I actually started to think about this when I was writing Four of the Three Musketeers, and I was mentioning in the introduction how I discovered them. Mm-hmm. What first jumped off the screen at me and appealed to me most was Harpo. I didn't quite get all of the verbal stuff. It was, above my head, or as I say, above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. I was a kid, like in the second or third grade, and I don't know what he's talking about, but it just seems really funny.
Exactly.
And later I learned what it was, and it was really funny, but Harpo doing the Punch and Judy show in Monkey Business, or Harpo going into the room and blowing up the ammunition, that's just funny if you're an 8-year-old kid and you don't know what's going on. That's just great stuff. And he appealed to me very, very much. And, I say this with reservations. He might still be my favorite Marx brother, quietly saying.
There's no wrong answer.
Well, yeah, if you tell, I love Zeppo too, but people think I'm crazy. That's why I've just finished a book about Zeppo. But
sometimes a good baseball utility man, he could be the most valuable player.
Oh, damn, yeah. Yeah, Zeppo could step in and play each of the Marx Brothers on stage in their vaudeville days. When somebody got sick, Zeppo would just do his part. Mm-hmm. And any schlemiel from the chorus could step in and do Zeppo. So that tells you a lot. But the answer to your question is I probably first saw Duck Soup maybe in 1970 or 71 on television in New York. I would have been about 10.
Okay.
I know the first one I ever saw was Monkey Business, and the second one I ever saw was Room Service.
I have to ask you a question. Like in my market in Chicago, I recall, I think It was almost like a tradition. Like in my market in Chicago, it would be New Year's Eve heading into New Year's Day, like late night TV.
Yeah, we had that.
They'd always play Top Hat with Fred Astaire, but then they'd play Duck Soup. Was that true in your market?
Our New Year's Eve thing, year after year, we was on Channel 9 in New York, would be occasionally they'd run a night at the opera and a day at the races, but they'd always traditionally run Jack Benny in The Horn Blows at Midnight.
Okay.
A movie that to this day I love.
Yeah, he always was self-deprecating about that film, but the truth is it's not bad.
It holds a special place in my heart, being a little kid who couldn't really go anywhere on New Year's Eve. There I was watching The Horn Blows at Midnight while my parents were out having God knows what kind of fun. And, you know, Marx Brothers movies in New York on television would turn up frequently. I was one of those kids, and I'm sure you did this too, would get the TV guide the second it was available on the newsstand and go through it with my red pen and circle anything to do with the Marx Brothers. And
you
at this
it.
Time, Groucho was still appearing on talk shows. So, you know, one of the great ironies for me is when he would pop up on the Dick Cavett show, I would diligently stay up late and record a cassette of it. And I've done a film or two with Dick Cavett now. We did a Groucho and Cavett film for American Masters that premiered last year. And I was doing an interview to promote that. And I said, it just strikes me as insane that all those years after I would record a cassette of this off television, I have the master tapes on my desk and I'm cutting a film out of them.
Wow.
That just blew my mind. But yeah, those days were very, very precious to me because Groucho was still out there, you know, very functional, very funny on television. And I do remember the first time I saw him on a talk show. And I had a little trouble equating him with the guy who was dancing on the desk in Horse Feathers.
Yeah, it's a leap. Mm-hmm.
But once you start hearing him talk and he's still funny, it's okay.
Right.
So you share the same experience that I had as a kid. They were very, very much out there. Movies were being shown, except for Animal Crackers, of course, which had some legal issues. But that did premiere again during the time when I was 13, I went to go see it, you know, so that was great. It was the last one that I hadn't seen. So between my probable discovery of them around 1969 and premiere of Animal Crackers when it came back in 74, I managed to see all their films for the first time. I saw a few of them two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would memorize all the dialogue from recording them off of TV on a cassette. I used to walk around listening to the Marx Brothers.
Wow. Wow. You and I live kindred spirit lives because I used to have a cassette recorder and I'd record movies off of television and listen to them as well. Not so much the Marx Brothers. That would have been a good idea. The problem was a lot of times they were shown very late at night in my market and I couldn't stay awake.
Well, you know,
I'd fall asleep, you know.
I would have the same issue. And I'll tell you a quick story. There was a point where I had not seen A Night in Casablanca, and it was right around when, this will bring back a memory to some people who are older than you are, maybe I am, when the Merv Griffin Show briefly went on CBS in late night against Johnny Carson and Dick Cavett. It bombed. It didn't do very well. And it quickly got moved into prime time on like a syndicated station thing. And they put late movies on. And one of the earliest of the late movies I remember was A Night in Casablanca, which I hadn't seen. Mm-hmm. And it was on the CBS late movie at 11:30 one night. And it was like a school night and my mother is making sure I'm in bed. And I got like an alarm clock under my pillow to make sure I get up and tape it, you know?
Wow. I was going to say, did you sneak out and try
Make
sure the parents were asleep and the whole thing?
Yeah. And I did that stuff with old movies all the time. I'd
look
in the TV guide. I remember I'm a big baseball fan. And, you know, one night when I was a little kid, Pride of the Yankees was on at 1 o'clock in the morning. I really wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I set an alarm clock under my pillow. I sneak out into the living room and I'm watching the movie. And my dad wakes up and he comes out and sees the light in the living room with the TV. He goes, "What are you doing? Go to bed. You got to go to school." I said, "I'm watching Pride of the Yankees." And my father
said,
"This
is school, Dad. This is my school.
My dad sat down and watched the rest of Pride of the Yankees with me.
Oh, that is such a great story. That's like a Field of Dreams or something.
In the morning, my mother is like looking at me and my father yawning.
That's so funny. I can relate real quickly. Small aside, we'll get back on track here, folks. But yeah, my biggest blind spot when I was a kid, because I was such a huge Star Wars fan, that was in my wheelhouse when it was released. And I just remember reading and hearing about Forbidden Planet and how that was an influence on George Lucas to some extent. So sure enough, it's on like after midnight on Channel 9 or something like that in Chicago. And it was even a weekend, but I couldn't stay awake. I kept getting up, splashing water on my face, slapping my face, and I kept falling asleep on it. So it wasn't until I was a teenager that I finally caught Forbidden Planet. So yeah, I can relate.
I'm going to tell you the secret to my success on watching movies in the middle of the night in those days.
Mm.
Mountain Dew.
I was not that clever, nor did I buy the groceries. So
I hadn't discovered coffee yet, so Mountain Dew was my thing.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, when you get older, you learn the tricks of the trade, what you need to do. But by that time, everything's on home video, so you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, you know, but to get back to your question, which was about, 3 hours ago, I probably first saw Duck Soup on Channel 5 in New York on a Saturday morning, probably around 1970 or 71. And immediately fell in love with it, mostly because the music knocked me out as a kid.
Ah, yeah. I was going to ask you, what is it about Duck Soup that is special to you and to a lot of others for that matter? What is it about this film, you know, 90 years later, we're talking about it, that maybe makes it the creme de la creme or among the very best if you think that this isn't quite the pinnacle? What is it about Duck Soup?
First of all, my favorite march for this film fluctuates between Monkey Business and Duck Soup all the time.
Ah,
catch me on another day and I'll say it's Duck Soup.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. I was obsessed always with the idea of the Marx Brothers on stage in front of a live audience and what they did with a live audience and how they tried to capture that in their first couple of films. And I loved the notion of the grand musical introduction of Groucho, which obviously, hooray for Captain Spaulding, you know, that's the industry standard right there.
Yeah, animal crackers.
And that to me takes us back to the Marx Brothers on stage with four of them, the grand introduction of Groucho. Whatever you think of Zeppo, he's important in that format. And I just love the way those films work. And Duck Soup is basically a better production because of what had happened in the early days of talkies. It's just a very well-produced opening sequence with that great His Excellency Is Due number. And then later in the film, Fredonia's going to war. I was knocked out by the music and the singing in those pictures. And as much as I love Monkey Business, it lacks that. You don't get that. But I also am a huge S.J. Perelman fan, which is another reason I love Monkey Business. His lines just jump off the screen at me.
Okay.
The greatest thing about Duck Soup, though, when I was a little kid, was those songs. I used to walk around singing His Excellency Is Due. People thought I was out of my mind. It was just a wonderful song. I love the music in that picture.
And yeah, you're not going to make a lot of friends on that playground.
No.
Humming that song.
And, and, you know, I'm against it. You know, also another great one from Horse Feathers.
Oh, yeah.
Those songs are wonderful. And the great thing about the Paramounts, and you get a lot of people talking about this later on, but I recognized it as a kid. The first time I saw A Day at the Races, there were these never-ending lengthy scenes that didn't have them.
Mm.
You can't really go through Duck Soup and not see a Marx Brother for more than 15 or 20 seconds.
Yeah, no, this is true.
You might get a quick scene with Trentino and Mrs. Teasdale, but before you know it, oh, good, Groucho's back. You don't have to worry. You're not going to get like a 6-minute scene of Alan Jones and Maureen O'Sullivan.
This is
you
the
know,
heart of
none
it.
Of that.
This is it, Robert, because for me, I totally agree. It's pure Marx Brothers Duck Soup. Start to finish,
exactly.
It's pure Marx Brothers. There's no tacked on song and dance numbers. There are no boring romantic storylines. There's no sentimentalism. There's no reliance on plot that often, you know, bogged down many of their later movies. It's wall-to-wall comedic efficiency and absurdist perfection to me. And it's crammed to the brim with verbal humor, with slapstick and satire and anarchic amusement for it's 68 minutes. It boggles the mind that it's only 68 minutes. It goes by in a flash.
If you're addicted to the Marx Brothers, Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and Duck Soup are like mainline.
Yeah.
There's no pablum. There's no filler. It's just pure, unadulterated Marx Brothers.
No question.
Those three films are the only ones that are like that.
But Duck Soup, to me in particular, is the purest distillation of Marxist humor on film. And it's still regarded as one of the, you know, downright funniest films ever created. It is, I think, number 5 on the AFI funniest list. That's all subjective. I get it. Everybody can have an opinion.
It's hard to disagree with an assessment like that. What sort of makes me laugh is, you know, at this point, there are books entirely devoted to Duck Soup, which is fine. Political satire. I've seen articles where they compare it to Dr. Strangelove. You know, that's wonderful. Great. I get it. When they were making these pictures, they had no idea. They didn't think of this stuff. Groucho was often asked about it. He would say, we were just trying to make a funny picture.
That's right.
They weren't sitting there doing political anarchy. They didn't know from that. They didn't care.
And a lot of these bits were pulled from their vaudeville, their stage act. So they had been well-rehearsed bits.
Well,
right?
Interestingly, Duck Soup is one of the early ones with this very little of that.
Is that true? Okay.
I'll tell you what comes from the stage act in Duck Soup. The courtroom scene. There was a lengthy, when Chico's on trial, there was a lengthy courtroom sequence in the middle of Alsatia's for no reason other than the producer of the play had a courtroom set, and they wrote a scene in because they had the set.
Okay.
And there's a random murder trial that takes place in the middle of Alsatias that if you take it out, it's fine. If you leave it in, it makes no sense, but they left it in. The earlier films always have stage material. Obviously, Coconuts and Animal Crackers are relying on stage scripts, but there's material in Animal Crackers, for example, with them coming to the party, you know, the musicians. These are all bits from earlier shows, particularly the bit where Harpo has stolen the silverware in Animal Crackers. Mm-hmm. That originally came from Home Again, their vaudeville show that they did for about 7 years, starting in 1915. So they were relying on that material. There's the famous double piano solo that you see in The Big Store, where Harpo and Chico were playing four-handed piano.
Yeah.
That bit comes from Mr. Green's reception in 1912. In Horse Feathers, the classroom lecture where they're doing the biology class, that's from Fun in High School from 1911. So they definitely worked some of their best stage bits into the movies with slightly modernized dialogue, whatever the situation
was. But you're saying that Duck Soup, a lot of this material was written directly for the film?
Yes and no. The original script of Duck Soup was very, very different. And it's a whole different scenario. For example, Zeppo had a much larger part. And this is where you get into the history of the four Marx brothers. Zeppo wanted out and didn't want to be in the four Marx brothers for a number of years. And they kept getting him to stay, family guilt. You can't do this to our mother. You can't do this to our father. You know, they really preyed on him to stay in the act. And when they made the deal to move to Hollywood in 1931, part of the arrangement was he would have more to do in the movies. So that's why in Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, he's featured. He even gets a little bit of the romantic lead. He gets the girl in Monkey Business.
That's right.
He gets to sing to Thelma Todd in Horse Feathers. Mm-hmm. And as originally scripted, when it was called Cracked Ice or Ooh La La or Grasshoppers or whatever one of the early titles they were going to use, in those early scripts, he has a romantic subplot with Raquel Torres, and he plays Firefly's son. He's originally called Bob Firefly. Mm. And they began to do preliminary recording for that. There are a couple of radio promo discs out there where you hear him referred to as the president's son, Bob Firefly. And in that version of the film, he was going to sing a song called Keep On Doing What You're Doing with Raquel Torres.
Hmm.
Well, Paramount was going through some financial trouble, and they were not making good on the residual payments for Horse Feathers and Monkey Business. And the Marx Brothers were concerned about it. And as part of a financial reorganization, Paramount created a shell company called Paramount Productions. The Marx Brothers were under contract to the parent company, Paramount Publix, and they transferred the Marx Brothers contract to the production company. That was a violation of the contract. So the Marx Brothers could not be transferred without their permission. And Paramount did it anyway. So the Marx Brothers walked off the set and said they wouldn't appear in the film. And they were going to go start an independent production company and do a film adaptation of The I Sing, the Pulitzer Prize winning musical.
Okay.
At this point, Paramount has the idea that they're going to get other actors to step in and do the roles the Marx Brothers were going to do.
Good luck with that.
It never really panned out. But the funny thing about that is that's how Leo McCarey ends up directing the picture.
Ah, okay.
Leo McCarey had just signed a new contract with Paramount, and he didn't want to work with the Marx Brothers because he thought they would be too difficult. Mm. So he didn't want the gig. But he signed this contract after the Marx Brothers walked out. He thought he'd be doing Duck Soup with these other actors. And that never worked out. And the Marx Brothers independent thing didn't work out. So by the time they came back, they had rewritten the film a little bit. And Zeppo's role got totally marginalized because by that point, they knew he was leaving. And he didn't really want to stay with the group anyway. So that's why he's barely in this picture.
Yeah.
But that's also how McCarey ended up doing it.
Oh, fascinating backstory. I'm so glad you're here to walk us through that. Even the minutiae, even the smaller details are important. They're important to this story and to our appreciation of how Duck Soup came to be made. So I find it really fascinating.
Well, you know, for the Three Musketeers, it's really called The Marx Brothers on Stage, but it does encompass all this stuff. And that book is basically hundreds of pages of minutiae, but hopefully woven together in an entertaining enough way that you won't kill yourself reading it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But getting back on track here and just finishing this thought, because there's so many other questions I'm dying to ask you about this film.
Yeah.
I just want to kind of finish the round it out a little bit about what makes Duck Soup special. So I've long said, you know, for my part, this is absolutely my favorite comedy of all time. It's my go-to, Robert, when I'm feeling blue. It was this trusty title I pulled off the shelf the night of the 2016 presidential election.
I voted for Firefly as a writing.
There you go. But it was the go-to flick the night before my colonoscopy and on other occasions when I needed a pick-me-up, right? So it never fails to put a smile on my face. I hear this from other people too, but it is my favorite comedy ever, and I think it always will be. I get that declaring which Marx Brothers movie is the funniest or the best, it's a very subjective exercise. People are going to have different opinions.
Well, your colonoscopy may be swaying me a little bit, so I might be thinking about that in the future. You know, interesting what you say, because if you've ever seen Hannah and Her Sisters, a great Woody Allen film, when he is convinced he has a brain tumor for no apparent reason, he goes into a movie theater to see Duck Soup when he thinks he's dying. And they cut to the screen, and it's the part where the Marx Brothers are doing the Heidi, Heidi Ho bit, the Cab Calloway thing. And Fredonia's going to war sequence. It's just, it's masterfully cut into the sequence in Hannah and Her Sisters.
And it's very moving. It's very moving. It's very humanistic. And it's such a brilliant use of that footage from the film. But it underscores how the Marx Brothers, their comedy can transcend just simply, you know, funny bone yucks. It can be existential comedy to some extent if you are of that persuasion. If you find that comedy is such a strong persuader to get your mind off your problems.
But your point is well taken in that it's believable as a film that somebody who thinks they're dying would be cheered up by.
Yeah.
It's that good. It's that persuasive and that
absolutely
strong. And, you know, as far as the political thing on that, which is funny, I don't want to say that I spend too much time analyzing Marx Brothers stuff, but I was thinking about this when I was preparing for this interview, and I didn't prepare that much.
I hope not. No, just come off the cuff.
Yeah, sir. I'm trying, but the thought occurred to me. Why does Ambassador Trentino want this country, Fredonia? They just blew $20 million. They need another $20 million. This is a terribly run country, and if Groucho knows that the guy is trying to steal his country, he's completely right to attack him and go to war with him.
You're going deep in the woods on your thinking
about
it.
But it's a true political assessment of Duck Soup is that Trentino's an idiot, and he deserves what Groucho does to him.
Oh, certainly.
So Firefly really is a grand statesman here. Because he's defending his ridiculously stupid country, but he's defending it.
Yep, it's true. Yeah, if you really want to dig into it. But, you know, it's just breaking down Duck Soup and thinking about what makes it great for me. It probably contains the most well-remembered Marx bit ever in the mirror sequence, right? Among the funniest, you know, running gags in Marxian cinema with the His Excellency's car routine. I always get a kick out of that.
Probably the only running gag in a Marx Brothers picture.
That's interesting you say that. Yeah, I was trying to think if there are any others, but it's a great one. And you think about the superbly delivered one-liners from Groucho. There's so many in here. There's that wonderful two-part pantomime diversion involving skirmishes with a lemonade vendor. Some of the very best malaprops from Chico and some of the very finest props, period, from Harpo. I mean, he on his person at any given time, he's got, what, a mousetrap, a blowtorch, a phonograph record, scissors, multiple squeeze bulb horns.
You just said the secret word. Harpo is nuts for scissors in this picture. Oh, yeah. And he's just cutting everything he sees.
It's beautiful.
And to me, the ultimate Harpo scissor gag, you don't even see Harpo do it. It's when Zeppo walks in and his hat's been cut in half.
Oh, it's great. It's so fast. I mean, if you're not paying attention, if you look away to grab soda or something, you're going to miss some great bits that just land. So many nonverbal, quick, zany bits that speak to the brilliance of Duck Soup. But also a handful, as you were saying, of the greatest songs in the brothers' filmography, including the Just Wait Till I Get Through With It number and the Country's Going to War song, which I'm going to quote USC film professor Drew Casper, who was on that great documentary on the box set I just watched again. He said that that Country's Going to War song uses every musical style that was known at this time. From Gilbert and Sullivan to operetta, you move into jazz, you move into Negro spirituals, you move into square dancing, bebop, it's amazing.
I love it.
I think he says it all. It's great. It's great. When you really dissect that, it's fantastic, that bouillabaisse of musical style.
It's just fun.
We're gonna walk all over the hell of the earth.
coming around the mountain with a banjo on my knee. Oh, pretty Donia, oh, Donia, cry for me.
When I was a kid and I first experienced it, I didn't know all of those styles. I didn't know what it was. To me, it was just Marx Brothers music. And I always loved the music in their films. And one of the most commonly asked questions is, how come there's no piano and harp in Duck Soup? Do you miss it? Well, I think McCary probably had something to do with that. I don't know this for sure, but he was all about the pacing and the timing and the comedy. Keep it coming, keep it coming.
Right.
And I think, you know, Harpo and Chico were known to be very much enjoying their own solos. And there's a story back when they were on stage where their wife, you know, Chico's wife would be concerned that Harpo's solo was a minute longer than Chico's. You know, you get, you know, stories like that. To actually have them both not, you know, to have them sacrifice it, I like to think they sacrificed it to make the comedy better.
Now, I'm curious about this. You of course, would be the person in the know. They didn't film any of those scenes that later got cut.
No, there's...
They knew from the start they weren't going to do that.
I don't recall any of the scripts I've seen for Duck Soup having those sequences. I don't think they did.
I was just curious if Leo McCary or the powers that be said, yeah, we're going to take this out. We're going to trim the fat.
I think they probably all agreed to it at that point because the Marx Brothers were powerful enough at Paramount to get what they wanted. And if they felt that they needed it, it would have been there. But they got their musical bits in there. They're all playing the banjo. You know, they're all doing their shtick.
Is this the only one where you don't have a Harpo solo and a Chico solo?
Mm-hmm. I don't think Room Service does, but I haven't seen it in a long time. Well, actually, I think one of the best musical solos in any of their films is, believe it or not, Harpo's solo in The Big Store, where he's on screen with himself a couple of times in these period costumes.
It kind of rings a bell, but it's been a long time.
He's playing, I think he's playing a cello and he's playing a violin.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
It's like
that.
A dream sequence, but it's beautifully done. It's really, really nice.
Now you piqued my interest. I got to go rewatch that.
Yeah, it's probably been 10 or 15 years since I watched The Big Store, but that resonates to me as the best thing in the movie.
So was Duck Soup innovative, influential, or the first of its kind in any way that you can trace, Robert?
You know, I want to go out on a limb here and say it might be the last of its kind for a long time, because Leonard and I talked about this on the commentary, and I recall really looking into this at the time. There was this very, very brief sort of moment in time where there was this little subgenre that I like to call the mythical kingdom film, and Million Dollar Legs made it Paramount with the same producer, Herman Mankiewicz, starred W.C. Fields and Harpo's future wife, Susan Fleming, and their country was called Klopstockia.
Okay.
They're raising money to send a team to the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1932. It was a cash-in film for the 32 Olympics. And then Wheeler and Woolsey did Diplomaniacs, which, while not on a mythical kingdom setting, was on an Indian reservation, and it was a similar sort of anarchic political statement film. And then Duck Soup comes along, and there's always been this theory out there that Duck Soup didn't do well or was a box office flop. You know, it's not really true. Every film that came out in 1932, 33, 34 didn't make as much money as the film before it, because the country was spiraling into the depression. It was getting worse and worse.
This is true.
So the Marx Brothers were not kicked out of Paramount because they're fifth film flopped. That is a myth. That is totally untrue. But I think the public sensibility wasn't begging for more political satire about mythical countries. There would be others later. I guess the Mouse That Roared is how many years later? My God, many, many years later. But there wasn't this sense that this was going to be a genre that took off.
Okay.
And I think the Marx Brothers weren't really wed to it. They said, hey, that's a funny script. Let's do it. You know, they liked it. That script came to be mostly because Groucho and Chico had agreed to do a radio show. And they brought in a lot of Groucho's good friends who were good writers. So you get, you know, S.J. Perelman and Arthur Sheikman and Nat Perrin and Calmar and Ruby started writing a little bit on it. And at some point, they said, wow, these radio gags work really well in this movie setting. And that's pretty much how Monkey Business was created. Monkey Business came out of that idea that they were going to work on a radio show. They also took a giant piece of their vaudeville show Home Again and used the premise to make Monkey Business. Home Again takes place on a dock after an ocean voyage when they return from a trip to Europe, and then there's a big party. Well, Monkey Business extrapolates on that theme by actually, you know, showing you the ocean voyage instead of it being like a 35-minute vaudeville sketch. It's a 70-minute movie where half the film is the ocean voyage, and then the finale is the party. So they were writing for radio. They were really going to take a shot at radio. Radio was becoming a big money thing for a lot of movie stars at the time. And it just never worked out for the Marx Brothers because they took the best stuff they'd written for radio and made a couple of their best pictures.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to answer the question about what was innovative or influential. You can make the case that this was maybe the last of its kind as far as a subgenre, the Magical Kingdom. That's interesting in tracing that lineage there. But many credit the Marx Brothers and partially this film, Robert, with helping to set maybe a more modern, relentless comedic pace, maybe ushering in a new era of what's been called absurdist cinema, which is, I guess, characterized by extremely silly, wildly irrational plots, characters who don't necessarily follow logical reasoning. So if you follow this through line, if you agree with this theory, you have this rapid fire cut and paste style editing, especially toward the end of Duck Soup, right? It's best exemplified when you've got the stock footage shots that depict the fire engines and the motorcyclists, the runners, the rowers, the divers, the monkeys, etc., rushing to aid Firefly. So maybe in small ways, and I realize that's a small sample size, but Duck Soup can feel like a funny flick far ahead of its time.
Well, I'll take you back a little bit. Where did Leo McCarey earn his stripes? The Hal Roach Studios doing silent comedies.
Laurel and Hardy, right.
He's the guy most responsible for pairing Laurel and Hardy, isn't he? I mean, I'm not a Laurel and Hardy expert. You'd have to call somebody else for that. But, you know, Leo McCarey put that stamp on a talkie with the Marx Brothers, and it's brilliant. So I wouldn't say that they were innovative in that sense. I think the idea of them doing it in a talkie, that style that you see at the end of Duck Soup, where everybody's help is on the way and everybody's coming to Fredonia. If you can't send help, send three more women. You know, that's a really great combination of what the Marx Brothers did to be a success in talkies and what McCarey did that was special at the Hal Roach Studios.
But here's the difference, though, and I'm not denigrating Laurel and Hardy, Leo McCarey, or any of the predecessors to Duck Soup. The newer generations of comedians remember the Marx Brothers, and they remember Duck Soup. They don't remember those other predecessors as much, and maybe that's a shame. I don't think I'm going out on a limb by saying that Duck Soup likely would have been more influential, more remembered.
Well, it's personal taste, but I know some Laurel and Hardy fans who would take you out in the alley and beat you up.
I gotcha.
I actually see it all as just kind of this big pot of stew that comes together. But I think Duck Soup is a moment in time in that lineage because it is sort of a silent film in a lot of ways. I mean, the greatest silent film scene in Duck Soup is Harpo in the apartment with the young lady. And of course, who comes home from work? The lemonade vendor that they've just desecrated. And Harpo's in the bathtub when Edgar Kennedy gets in the bathtub.
It's great stuff.
You know, that sequence, that could be a silent comedy short. The whole lemonade stand bit could be a silent comedy short. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of silent comedy in there, even including the fact that you even have Edgar Kennedy in the picture.
It's true.
Harpo's gags in that film, you know, the idea of the gag where Edgar Kennedy shoots the water into Harpo's pants. That's a silent comedy bit. So Harpo's, again, like in every picture, he's in his own world. But in this particular case, he's in his own world, and it's like a silent movie. And he's got Leo McCarey and Edgar Kennedy helping him. I think it's one of Harpo's strongest performances because of that.
No question about it. Yeah, no, I totally agree. But getting back to my point here, just in terms of the influential nature, I mean, when you do the research, and of course, you are the master of this because you've written about it extensively, you've talked about it, you do commentaries on it. So I defer to your expertise, of course, and you don't have to agree with what I'm about to say. But in the limited, you know, kind of scouring around that I've done and reading about and listening and so forth, it sounds like a lot of more modern comedians, filmmakers, people who create content really tip a cap to the Marx Brothers above a lot of other comedians and predecessors. So maybe, to some extent, the Marx Brothers, best represented in Duck Soup perhaps, deserve credit for helping inspire several generations of comedians and filmmakers and new styles of comedy in their wake. Here's the lineage I'm going to lay out, okay? Think of the classic Looney Tunes animation style. Is there a Bugs Bunny without Groucho Marx?
Bugs Bunny is Groucho Marx.
He pretty much is. And then you think about Daffy Duck and the absurdity of his character, especially as he gets into the Chuck Jones era. Monty Python-esque humor that veers into surrealist or illogical territory, I think, would definitely owe a nod to Marx Brothers' style of comedy to some extent. Like I said, visual cut and paste style comical montage that we just talked about. Daring political satire. Chaplin's The Great Dictator a few years later. Sacha Baron Cohen's The Dictator just in the last 10 or so years. Comedy that isn't afraid to break the fourth wall and defy the traditional structure of film comedy. I understand the Marx Brothers weren't the first to do it, but talking to the audience and, you know, having a doghouse tattoo that reveals a live-action dog, it breaks the fourth wall. I think that the bits in Duck Soup in particular are quite memorable there. You mentioned Dr. Strangelove, Kubrick's film, another war comedy and political farce that employs, you know, irony, verbal humor in similar ways. And even the Beatles, the movie Help or A Hard Day's Night to some extent, they've credited Duck Soup as an inspiration, especially for Help. The films of Woody Allen, we've already talked about this, particularly Bananas. Now, the plot of Bananas is somewhat similar to Duck Soup in that it's a government kind of fledgling with leadership. Modern comedy sketches, TV shows, films that dare to break the rules. Contemporary comedy director Judd Apatow is a huge fan of the Marx Brothers. He said that the first movie that had an impact on me as a person interested in comedy was Duck Soup. I was a fanatical Marx Brothers fan as a 10-year-old. It might have been because I loved their rebellion. It seemed like they were flipping the bird to everyone. And then, of course, Robert, the famous mirror sequence. Now, they may not have invented that. That might have been kind of cribbed from some predecessors. But it's been copied and reimagined multiple times in cartoons, right? You think about Mickey Mouse, Bugs Bunny, the Pink Panthers done it, Tom and Jerry, Garfield, Family Guy, The Simpsons, that famous episode of I Love Lucy that co-starred Harpo. It speaks for itself, right? I think that's a pretty strong argument that this was a very influential film on a lot of different people.
You covered a lot of ground there. Max Linder first did the mirror scene, as far as I understand it, in a French silent comedy around 1921 or 22.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So it's been a famous comedy bit that's been used through the years. The notion, I think somewhere back at the beginning of that, you said something about what makes them still relevant and what makes them still work.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory that's not necessarily my own theory, but I'm going to lay this on you and you can cut it out if you don't like it. So there's a difference between, say, the Marx Brothers and Wheeler and Woolsey, who were equally popular at the time these films were being made, and they're all but forgotten now. And what makes the big difference to me is the situations they're in. Any film can become dated. It's very easy for a film from 1933 to be considered a dated film. But the Marx Brothers are not dated because they flout convention. When Groucho flips off the cabinet, or when Groucho insults the faculty of a college, or when he just insults the rich lady that he wants to get money from, these are things that are still relevant. You know, I look at something like The Honeymooners on television. One of my favorite things ever is The Honeymooners. They're right up there with the Marx Brothers for me.
Yeah, agreed.
And what makes that show still work is that it's not about being in Brooklyn in the mid-50s and driving a bus. It's about the situations between a husband and a wife who are on a tight budget and they have a nutty neighbor. That still works. That idea of the guy living next to his best friend, I mean, the Flintstones is the Honeymooners. The wacky neighbor tradition goes into Rhoda on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Howard Borden on the Bob Newhart Show, Kramer on Seinfeld. It's a great comedic device, but it's about the relationship, not the situation.
But it's also the fantastic talent of Jackie Gleason and Art Carney. But, and in this context, you could argue, tell me if you disagree here, the fact that the Marx Brothers were kind of rediscovered in the late 60s by the boomer generation, I mean, that speaks a lot to, obviously, Groucho outlived his brothers, and he made the circuit, so to speak, at that time, where he's reappearing suddenly in pop culture and appearing on talk shows. And people are rediscovering how incredibly funny and witty this man is. And I think it's Groucho, as the steward of his brother's legacy, that really helps catapult the Marx filmography into the later 20th and now 21st century. I think that there's some impetus there, and it speaks to the talent, of course, of Groucho, but also his brothers, no question. But I mean, without Groucho and that charisma in particular, I don't know if the Marx Brothers get as well remembered as some of their peers.
It helps for sure, but let me also point something out that never gets talked about.
Okay.
The Marx Brothers were never out of the public consciousness. Universal became the owner of their Paramount films in the late 40s, early 50s, and they were never not seen on television. They created a holding company to market their films to television.
That's a huge point. Yeah, the repeat viewings on TV.
The Marx Brothers Paramount films were on television almost from the day television began and never left. The Animal Crackers copyright problem began in 58. So from like 48 to 58, it was on television.
It's kind of like the Three Stooges, right? They persist because they've been perennially on television for generation to generation.
That's true. But in the case of the Marx Brothers, Groucho was a huge hit on television all through the 1950s. He had a top 10 show from the beginning of television until 1961.
You bet your life.
There was never a moment where he wasn't in the popular culture. And then in the 60s, he was a regular guest on talk shows and game shows and all kinds of cockamamie television shows. He would do anything. Groucho was on Celebrity Billiards. He was on panel shows all the time. He was great on those shows. He would be on, you know, What's My Line or To Tell the Truth, go on Johnny Carson, on Merv Griffin, on later on Cabot. There was never a time when Groucho wasn't out there during the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s. The fact that people on college campuses who were anti-war during the Vietnam era discovered Duck Soup, that's just a little, you know, shot in the arm for the whole cause if you're trying to promote the Marx Brothers. But it didn't bring them back from obscurity. They were never obscure. That's the thing that's important. If you look at old newspapers and TV guides and you look and see, the films were constantly being reissued. Now, the funny thing about it, if you dig really deep and you drill down, MGM was anti-television. Louis B. Mayer hated television. He thought it was going to destroy movie revenue. MGM didn't let any of their movies go on television until 1955. So the first several years of television, you know, Night at the Opera, Today at the Races, no. They did a theatrical reissue of A Night at the Opera in 1948. They did a reissue of The Big Store, I think, in 58. So the MGM films were being theatrically reissued through the 50s into the early 60s. The Paramounts, you know, they pop up in theaters once in a while, but they're all over television. That was why the audience found those Paramount films much easier than the MGMs at that time. So it's an interesting thought to say that, you know, Duck Soup during the Vietnam era brought the Marx Brothers back, but it just isn't true.
Okay.
It's gotcha. Another myth that's like the myth that they got bounced out of Paramount because Duck Soup bombed. Not true. They walked out of Paramount. They quit and came back to make the movie to settle a contract dispute and then went on their own and signed with MGM. So two of the things that we hear the most about Duck Soup are the two things that I just said. They didn't flop and get dropped by Paramount. Paramount was trying to re-sign them. In fact, when Zeppo left and Paramount was trying to re-sign them, they were concerned because they wanted to keep the name The Four Marx Brothers, and they couldn't get Zeppo to reconsider. There were things planted in the press that they were going to bring Gummo back. Gummo was probably shuddering at the thought.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
He couldn't wait to get out of the act himself. You know, right. There's also, like, Groucho made a lot of jokes about it later on when they were negotiating with Thalberg. He wanted to pay him less for being a trio. And Groucho said, don't be ridiculous. We're worth much more without Zeppo. So, you know, these were the jokes that he liked to say. But at the time it was happening, the Marx Brothers were skirmishing a little bit there. They were kind of worried. They were not sure they were going to have the market value as a trio that they did as a quartet. But it was a legitimate concern. But the difference between Paramount and MGM really comes up again in the 50s when, you know, you can't find the MGM films, but you can find the Paramount films all over television.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, before we move on to my next question, just one more arrow in the quiver of the argument that the Marx Brothers were incredibly influential. I just want to quote briefly Roger Ebert. Although they were not taken as seriously, they were as surrealist as Dolly, as shocking as Stravinsky, as verbally outrageous as Gertrude Stein, as alienated as Kafka. Because they worked as genres of slapstick and screwball, they did not get the same kind of attention. But their effect on the popular mind was probably more influential. Duck Soup has moments that seem startlingly modern, as when Groucho calls for help during the closing battle sequence, and the response is stock footage edited together out of newsreel shots of fire engines, elephants, motorcycles, you name it.
Calling all nations, calling all nations. This is Rufus T. This is Rufus T. Firefly coming to you through the courtesy of the enemy. We're in a mess, folks, we're in a mess. Rush to Fredonia. Three men and one woman are trapped in the building. Send help at once. If you can't send help, send two more women. Make it three more women. Which one of us is going to have the rare privilege of sacrificing his life for his country?
We draw lots. Wait, I got it. Rinse spot. One shot, two shot, zigzag, zap. Pop dive, and you get 10 light tap. Hair him, scare him, mites and tear him, tear, tore. I did it wrong. Wait. I start here. Rinspot, bunza, twoza, zigza, say, trap type, and he get in like that, head him, scare him, wipes him, tear him, tear him, tear him, it's no good, too. Oh, I got it, I got it. Rinspot, go!
You're a brave man. Go and break through the lines. And remember, while you're out there risking life and limb through shot and shell, we'll be in here thinking what a sucker you are. Goodbye, Mont Blanc, goodbye.
There's an odd moment when Harpo shows Groucho a doghouse tattoo on his stomach, and in a special effect, a real dog emerges and barks at him. The brothers broke the classical structure of movie comedy and glued it back again haphazardly, and nothing was ever the same.
It's a great quote. I would just venture to add to it that, well, I won't add to it because Roger Ebert doesn't need my help. Of all those people he mentioned, are there any more accessible to an audience than the Marx Brothers? There's something for everyone in the Marx Brothers.
You're absolutely right.
That's what I think the key is. And I want to make, before we go, I have to make sure I tell you something about that tattoo gag. In the original scripted version of that gag, it's a guy taking a leak in an outhouse, and Groucho like apparently knocks on the door, opens the door, and the guy turns around and pulls the door shut because he's taking a leak. That did not pass muster because of the production code.
Wow, that's a great story. And it actually is a good segue into my next question. How might Duck Soup have been considered risque, controversial, or rattling the cage a little bit for 1933?
Have you seen those dresses that Raquel Torres is constantly falling out of?
Oh, yes, I have. And, you know, 2023... she still looks pretty darn good.
Yeah, Raquel Torres, I believe her real name is Paula Osterman.
Wow.
Not the Mexican Spitfire like Lupe Velez.
Is that right? I didn't know that. Okay.
But that accent is, maybe it's real. I think Leonard and I were debating whether it was real or not on the commentary. It made me laugh because I was thinking about it the other night. But pre-code, yeah. The notion that when Chico is under the bed and Harpo weaves and Margaret Dumont starts taking off her robe and you briefly see her undergarments and she throws it back on. Oh my God, you saw my undergarments. That's code stuff. And this is on the cusp, really. March of 34 is when they start really enforcing the code. I think the outhouse gag was just kind of like, that's disgusting. Let's do a doghouse. You know, I don't think, you know, I'm not sure if he even went to the production code office, but it was changed. And it's the only thing I could find in there that they changed to be a little less tasteless. But the idea of, first of all, Raquel Torres is wearing a different dress in every shot you see her in. And that's another surrealistic gag. Groucho's costumes keep changing during the war scene. Mm-hmm. You know, this is them just having a blast, having fun. It's silliness. Yes, surrealism, sure. The accessibility of the Marx Brothers makes people watch surrealism without realizing they're watching surrealism. I think that's the beauty of it. As a kid watching that film, I had just been overjoyed by everything about it, mostly the music. And then as I watched it over and over again through the years, oh my God, he's got like six different costumes in the war scene. That's great.
It's beautiful.
And you know, the bit where the vase is on his head and they blow it up like a firecracker.
Classic.
You know, these things just, you get sucked into it. There's nothing that surreal in the other Marx Brothers movies.
Agreed.
Are they putting a firecracker to blow up the vase that he got stuck on his head in any other film? Is there a gag that could even be like that in another film?
No. Right.
I mean, this Duck Soup is almost like an animated cartoon in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It has some of the later stuff of like Frank Tashlin built into it. You know, it's just they were served best by writers who had done cartoons and comic strips. A lot of guys who worked on Monkey Business were cartoonists. Perlman was a cartoonist.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that surreal thing going on. But I think in later films, there was much, much less of it. I think you get a little surrealism in A Night at the Opera when the butterfly comes out from the guy's beard. You know, but Duck Soup, it's wall-to-wall surreal. It's just, it's a different Marx Brothers film. And it still works because everybody would like to see that kind of a government. I think, especially now, that government of Fredonia is a breath of fresh air. It really is.
Yeah, it's definitely an alternate reality kind of exploration of what if, too. And just getting back to this question of what might have been controversial, I mean, let's put it in historical context. You know, 33, that's the year the Hitler comes to power, right? Mussolini has recently risen to the ranks of power. And the film kind of skewers their fascist tendencies over the coals, if you will. It mocks warmongers and the absurdity of war, certainly. It ridicules jingoism, you could argue, patriotism to some extent. It even labels soldier volunteers as suckers. In a roundabout way, Robert, it lampoons religion and gun-owning conservatives with the, you know, we got guns, they got guns, all God's chillin's got guns.
I don't think anybody was thinking about the gun thing in 1933.
A lot of people confuse the opening NRA message. That's not the National Rifle Association.
No, right? Leonard mentions that at the beginning of the commentary.
That's right.
It's the National Recovery Act. But
a lot of people fall for that.
You know, I think a lot of people fall into the trap of judging material from 90 years ago by today's standards. You run into a lot of that.
Okay.
You know, the Marx brothers had no idea they were being, you know, anarchistic politically. They weren't doing that. They were looking for the next funny script. And this one about this silly little country appealed to them.
Yeah.
I don't think they were trying to make that statement that now people ascribe to it.
Do you think they were poking fun at, you know, Roosevelt's cabinet or the New Deal or anything like that?
It wouldn't surprise me if they were. They went back as far as the, you know, in the 1920s,
uh-huh,
when they were on Broadway doing Coconuts. Mayor Jimmy Walker, the legendary corrupt mayor of New York City, walks in after the show started. He's heading down to his box, and Groucho stops the show and walks to the front of the stage and says, "Mayor Walker, what are you doing here? Shouldn't you be out stuffing ballot boxes?" You know, you get stuff like that. Mm. They always went after authority and politicians, never a question. So are they specifically going after fascism on the rise? Did they even know? I mean, Groucho stayed politically aware. I don't think Harpo was that concerned with it, although he did. He had just been in Moscow. You know, well, he went to Moscow, I should say, after the film came out, and he played in Moscow and Leningrad. And he came home and he gave some interviews saying about the terrible things he saw. So he was aware. But I think it was after Duck Soup.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because if you're correct, it's not like they planned it this way necessarily. Like, oh, yeah, Hitler's...
They definitely didn't.
Yeah, Hitler's just come to power, so we'll make a movie poking fun of him.
No,
right,
no.
They didn't do that.
They definitely did not do that. That's documentable.
But then you can make the argument, if you choose to see it this way, that Duck Soup is all the more admirable because maybe it's eerily prescient or predictive. You think about how Firefly fashions himself as a fascist dictator in a film shot just months before Hitler came to power. Brian Eggert, who does the Deep Focus review essays, he said this: when Firefly kills his own men and then tries to cover it up, he does so 2 years before Humphrey Cobb wrote his book Paths of Glory, a real-life account of a French general who did the same thing during the First World War. When Firefly sings, "The last man nearly ruined this place, he didn't know what to do with it. If you think this country's bad off now, just wait till I get through with it. Try not to think of someone like Hitler or Donald Trump," he writes. Mussolini even banned Duck Soup in Italy after a twinge of recognition. To be sure, the film, either through intentional or coincidental circumstances, underlines a historical pattern of insane people taking over bankrupt nations, unquote.
Are you aware of the fact that there are now entire books devoted to Hollywood's collaboration with Hitler's government?
I've heard rumors to the effect, but I've not read any.
It's true. There's a couple of really good books about it. The studios were very concerned with those markets. They were not going to make films that insulted them. That was never the intention. The German market was valuable. They sent these films over there in dubbed versions. They made money. They actually, as the war escalated, made films that were sympathetic to the Nazis. The Marx Brothers had no interest in this, had no idea that this was being considered. And 90 years later, to give them credit for skewering Hitler and Mussolini, you know, when Groucho found out that Mussolini banned the movie, he was amused and happy about it. But he didn't do it to get that reaction. They didn't know. Groucho would always say, "We were just trying to make funny pictures."
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to try and apply modern sensibilities to a 90-year-old movie.
But, you know, I'm not afraid to ask the question, because where there's smoke, there might be fire. Maybe there's not. So, you know, in digging through some of these things, these questions get raised.
Now, Chaplin, if you want to talk about the great dictator, 100% different situation. Chaplin was deliberately going after Hitler,
mm-hmm,
and Jack Oakey steals the picture as Benzino Napoloni, the Mussolini character. That film, you get a completely different answer out of me. Chaplin was going after fascists, and he was going after Hitler and Mussolini. The Marx Brothers were just trying to make a funny picture and move on with their career.
Yeah, hear, hear.
At the time the Marx Brothers made Duck Soup, their biggest concern was their contract and their future. They didn't care about politics.
Yeah, I get it. But like any work of art, let's say a song, I mean, the artist can intend one thing, but we can interpret it how we see fit. If it means something and resonates in a way that maybe doesn't jive with what the artist intended, that doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong.
Well, now you got to go interview Bruce Springsteen about what Born in the USA actually means.
There you go. I'm dying to hear your take here on what is it about the Marx Brothers individually and as a collective that works so well. I just want a kind of a synthesis of, okay, let's break it down if we can. Groucho has this bag of tricks. Chico has this. Harpo has this. But when they come together, they're greater than the sum of their parts.
Well, that goes back to the conception of the act in vaudeville. And that's an easy thing for me to tackle because half of my book about their stage career delves into this. The early days of vaudeville, it was entertainment focused on getting an immigrant new to the country, maybe not that great with the language, to come to see a nickel vaudeville show. And what you would get there is a lot of ethnic humor. Immigrant accents were very, very big in vaudeville. They gradually went away because they became sort of considered to be insulting. Chico never shed the Italian accent. Harpo was originally a speaking character who was an Irish kid. And Gummo was called the Hebrew boy. And Groucho was the German. Groucho lost the German thing when World War I broke out and it was no longer cool to be German on stage. So he became more of a non-ethnic character, and gradually ethnicity fled out of vaudeville. But what really was interesting is that the Marx Brothers were conceived as an act to appeal to many different people. So there would be something in their act for everybody who came to a small town vaudeville theater. If you didn't speak English too well, you had Chico to identify with. You didn't need to understand any language to identify with Harpo.
Right.
If Groucho spoke a little too fast for you, didn't get all the jokes, you know, your friend could explain it to you.
Oh, Rufus.
All I can offer you is a Rufus over your head.
Your Excellency, I really don't know what to say.
I wouldn't know what to say either if I was in your place. Maybe you can suggest something. As a matter of fact, you do suggest something. To me, you suggest a baboon.
What?
I'm sorry I said that. It isn't fair to the rest of the baboons.
This man's conduct is inexcusable. Why, I'll...
Gentlemen, gentlemen!
I did not come here to be insulted.
Oh,
that's what you think.
You swine.
Come again?
You worm.
Once more?
You upstart.
That's it.
Oh. Touché. Mrs. Teasdale, oh. I'm afraid this regrettable occurrence may plunge our countries into war.
Oh, this is terrible.
I've said enough. I'm a man of few words.
I'm a man of one word, Scram. A man doesn't live who can call a firefly an upstart. Why, the Mayflower was full of fireflies. And a few horseflies, too. The fireflies run the upper deck and the horseflies run the fireflies.
You know, it was a very well thought out concept. And as it evolved into the movies, there were things that appealed to certain parts of the population. They were notorious for not having female fans at Paramount. There are these things in motion picture world where the managers of the theaters were saying that, you know, the women didn't care for it, you know, that kind of thing.
The same was said of the Three Stooges, right? They weren't very popular.
Yeah, well, women never cared. I have a theory that women are missing the chromosome that allows them to enjoy the Three Stooges.
Okay.
But when Thalberg took the Marx Brothers in at MGM, they decided to make films that would appeal to women.
That's right.
Given the romantic subplots and the songs and all that. And financially, it worked. Those pictures made more money. Night at the Opera, Day at the Races made more money than all five Paramount films combined. You know, the Marx Brothers' take on those movies was exorbitant because they got a better contract. They learned from Paramount's financial trickery that having 50% of the net was worthless because Paramount was cheating on the expenses. So when they went to MGM, they learned that 15% of the gross was much better than 50% of the net of Paramount.
There you go.
And, you know, suppose Groucho once said something like the first checks that came in for a Night at the Opera was something like $600,000 in 1935-36 money.
Mm-hmm.
That was much more money than they, I mean, when they settled their financial dispute with Paramount over horse feathers and monkey business, I think the settlement amounted to something like $32,000.
But what strikes me here is just the dynamism, the synergy between the brothers, again, greater than the sum of the parts. And this is a team-based comedy in which each brother has a unique comedic styling, a talent set that works well together or separately. Unlike, let's say, Abbott and Costello or maybe the Three Stooges or Laurel and Hardy to some extent, you know, Groucho, Chico, and Harpo don't always have to be in the same scene together. They can each work, you know, solo scenes to outstanding results.
In fact, they rarely are, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between the Marx Brothers on stage and the Marx Brothers on screen is that they did a lot of stuff on stage as a quartet with all four of them involved in a sequence.
Okay.
If you've ever seen that sequence called the Theatrical Manager's Office, you could actually find it on Blu-ray, on the Too Many Kisses Blu-ray from Film Preservation Society. It's in there with a film called The House That Shadows Built. It's an example of what they looked like on stage doing a thing with all four of them. And it really showcases that Zeppo was a part of the act. when they got on the screen, they had to hit their marks. There was a limited amount of space for the four of them. So they kind of broke it down into two teams. And you'd see Groucho doing shtick with Zeppo and to some degree Chico, and Chico and Harpo doing their bit. You rarely see Groucho and Harpo working together as a duo, which is the beautiful thing in Duck Soup with the sidecar gag.
Yep.
It's a really, really rare example of Groucho and Harpo together.
Or the mirror sequence. That's Groucho and Harpo.
Well, that's the three of them. That's really the three of them.
But it's mostly Groucho and Harpo.
Sure. And you get the opening scene of the big store, which everyone forgets when they're in Wolf J. Flywheel's office. And Harpo's like cooking eggs in the desk and stuff like that. They do break down into teams within the team. But the thing about the appeal, I just think there's something for everyone there. Harpo was later kind of developed into a character that appealed to women. If you look at some of the later films, Harpo's the sympathetic character. To some people, when Lespari beats him in Night at the Opera, that's the beginning of the end. And when Groucho gets kicked down the stairs in A Night at the Opera, it's pretty much over. You know, the anarchist is gone. We've now got a pathetic guy being kicked down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, it is a big jump for some.
But women came to that picture in droves and felt sympathy for Harpo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big deal at the box office. So the anarchistic films that we love simply made less money. Doesn't make them less great in my eye.
Right. A lot of purists say the Paramount films are the best distillation of their comedy. So it's just an interesting examination of the team-based comedy approach, but also how the brothers could work solo in the film or paired up in different configurations.
Yeah, I also give Chico a lot of credit. I always want to say this. Chico's sort of the link. If you want to have Groucho communicate to Harpo, you kind of need Chico in there to be
go
the...
between.
He's like the translator in a sense. You know, it's very important. His role in the act is really undervalued by critics. I think if you study the films and you really look at them, he becomes more important as you really look at the chemistry.
Sure, absolutely. Same could be said of Abbott to Costello.
Yeah, but there's not a third member of that group to
True,
bring
it's
in.
It's different. Mm-hmm.
But I think what Chico brings to the table is so valuable, first of all, musically, and he's a legitimate comedian in his own right.
Certainly.
What is it? Has a trunk with no key, weighs 2,000 pounds and lives in a psychic.
That's irrelevant.
Irrelevant? Hey, that's the answer. There's a whole lot of relevance in the circus.
That sort of testimony we can eliminate.
That's a fine. I'll take some.
You'll take what?
Eliminate. A nice gold glass of lemonade. Hey, boss, I'm going to good.
The shtick he does with A.B. the Fish Peddler in Animal Crackers, it's as good as anything Groucho does in the film.
And I absolutely love the Tootsie Fruity ice cream from Day at the
Races. Yeah, I mean, and of course, that's you rarely see a scene with Chico's working with other actors and not with Groucho.
Right.
But, you know, the bit with Louis Soren and Animal Crackers playing A.B. the Fishman, I love that. He, by the way, turns up in The Honeymooners years later as Mr. Manicotti.
Okay.
For you trivia buffs, A.B. the Fishman, Mr. Manicotti, same guy.
I think he was the first of the three to pass away, correct?
Yeah, Chico died in 1961, Harpo in 64.
64, okay. And Groucho passed, was it the late 70s?
1977.
77, yeah. I think the same year as Elvis.
The same week as Elvis.
Wow.
1977 was a tough year if you went by one name. We lost Groucho, Elvis, Chaplin, and Bing.
Oh, wow. That's a rough one.
Yeah.
So how can you convince someone who's never seen or let alone heard of the Marx Brothers, maybe a younger set, to give them a chance to maybe watch a film like Duck Soup? What's your pitch?
Give me 68 minutes and you'll never regret it. Duck Soup flies by. It's over before you know it. Same thing is true of Monkey Business. Same thing is true of Horse Feathers. Was it 71 minutes, 77 minutes, and 68 minutes? Those three films, my God. You know, devote an hour and change to this and you will become a fan. It's hard not to. If you've ever gone to college, watch Horse Feathers. You know, if you've ever voted in an election, watch Duck Soup. It's there for you to discover. Now, I get a lot of people whose favorite film is A Night at the Opera. I think a lot of people say that because Groucho always said it was his favorite film. And Groucho said it was his favorite film because it made the most money. Make no mistake about it. He was totally involved in that film because it made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And he also wanted to pay homage to Thalberg because he died so young and he wanted to keep calling Thalberg a genius. But on the merits, if we just look at those films as comedies, how can you say A Night at the Opera is a better film than Duck Soup? I mean, some people prefer it, but it's just simply judged as a comedy. It's not. It's not a better film than Duck Soup.
Pretty close in my book. I'd rank it actually number two. But again, the problem is that about a quarter of the movie is filler that needs to be cut.
if you could somehow never hear the song alone for the rest of your life.
Right. Mm-hmm. But boy, that stateroom scene and the actual opera sequences are gold.
Pure genius in there. And it's George S. Kaufman. Mm-hmm. Groucho said, get me the great writers that we had in the beginning and we'll be making great movies again. And he's 100% right. Kaufman and Riskin are integral. It's very important that George S. Kaufman be brought in for that film. Mm-hmm. And they went and got Margaret Dumont for that film. And you know, my forthcoming biography of Zeppo will tell you exactly how they got Margaret Dumont for that film.
Wow. Yeah, we will get to that in a moment. I just have to ask you, and I'm not trying to nitpick. I know it's so easy 90 years later. This is a dated film in so many ways. Let's be honest. But maybe there are some problematic elements that we should briefly touch on. So, sure. For example, you know, Harpo, the sexually aggressive physicality toward women, that's not going to play too well in 2023. Chico's ethnic stereotyping, the line about that's why darkies were born.
The Marx Brothers just make a passing reference to it because it's a popular song. There are always going to be contemporary references in Marx Brothers pictures. It's that he's mentioning the name of a song that was on everybody's mind at the time. They didn't know these films were going to have the shelf life that they ended up with.
Yeah, I've heard from other people that there are some troublesome aspects with that line, with that singing sequence.
I'm a middle-aged white guy. What do I know? But I'm telling you that that's never struck me as the least bit racist, whereas I cringe at some of the stuff. I love Eddie Cantor. I cringe at some of the stuff in the Eddie Cantor movies where he's in blackface. Mm. I love Bing Crosby. There's some cringeworthy blackface in Bing Crosby pictures, but it's of its time. And
sure.
It's,
well, I think the important thing is censorship isn't necessarily the first go-to. It should be a dialogue. It should be, you know, let's put it in context of the time. Let's have a talk about it. Let's see if some of this stuff bothers some people, and let's have a discourse about it as opposed to just scissors. Let's cut it out. Did we miss anything that was on your mind that may be problematic in the film that rubs you the wrong way today?
I just wish it was even longer and had more stuff in it, but I love the film. This film is 90 years old.
You're absolutely right. This is the 90th birthday of Duck Soup. Birthdays are a time for giving presents. Only it's the fans who continue to receive the gifts when a beloved film marks a milestone year. So what do you believe is Duck Soup's greatest gift to viewers?
If you're new to the Marx Brothers, what I said earlier about it being sort of a surreal entry in their filmography, it's got a little bit of everything. It's sort of like titled Duck Soup. Maybe they just threw everything in the pot. It's got all the things that make them great, with the notable exception of harp and piano solos. And some people find those dull. I enjoy them. But pound for pound, it just never misses a beat. It's just joke, joke, joke. It's a comedy from start to finish. I think along with Monkey Business, it stands alone in that sense that they're just rapid fire comedies of their period. They transcend the notion of being dated, in my opinion. There's nothing dated about it, not even the costumes, because the costumes are so ridiculous and ornate that it's a fantasy film. If you look at the people's costumes in the opening sequence when Firefly is introduced, that could be 1980. I mean, they're wearing like dress-up gowns for like a cotillion ball or something. You know, what is that sequence? Where is that taking place? Who are those people? You know, you see the poor people, you know, in the courtroom scene in the gallery, they could be the people I see on the streets of Los Angeles today.
Yeah, it just feels like fairy tale land to me. It feels timeless.
It does not become dated because of anything within it. And the sensibility about the silliness of war, you know, I've already paid a month's rent on the battlefield, stuff like that. It still works. It's very, very timely. I think it stays relevant. And I think the Marx Brothers mostly stay relevant because they're dealing with situations that still come up. You know, you still have pompous college professors.
True.
You still have idiotic government.
Yep.
There's idiotic government in every party. Yeah, and Fredonia, who knows how bad the guy before was? maybe he was worse than Firefly. You don't know.
Good point.
Your Excellency, here's the Treasury Department's report. I hope you'll find it clear.
Clear? Why, a four-year-old child could understand this report. Run out and find me a four-year-old child. I can't make head or tail out of it. And now, members of the cabinet, we'll take up old business.
I wish to discuss the tariff.
Sit down. That's new business. No old business? Very well. And we'll take up new business.
Now about that tariff.
Too late. That's old business already. Sit down.
Gentlemen, as your Secretary of War,
The Secretary of War is out of order. Which reminds me, so is the plumbing. Make a note of that. Never mind. I'll do it myself.
Department of Labor wishes a report that the workers of Fredonia are demanding shorter hours.
Very well, we'll give them shorter hours. We'll start by cutting their lunch hour to 20 minutes.
And now, gentlemen, we've got to start looking for a new treasurer.
But you appointed one last week.
That's the one I'm looking for.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, enough of this. How about taking up the tax?
How about taking up the carpet?
I still insist we must take up the tax.
He's right. You've got to take up the tax before you can take up the carpet.
And I'll say this other silly thing. I love Louis Calhern in this movie so much, and I'm a fan of his other work, Trentino, too. When I see something like Notorious, and he's the guy, he's like sort of the spy master for both of them.
Yeah, he's also in The Asphalt Jungle.
Oh, he's brilliant in The Asphalt Jungle. Yeah, that's one of his best films. But I think of him in Notorious as like, so after he got run out of Sylvania, maybe this is what Trentino ended up doing. He's working for the OSS in the U.S., and he's a spy master because he's appropriately aged. It's, what, 10 years later or so? So I like to think that Trentino continued on his life as a scoundrel, and he's a spy.
Parallel universes, yeah. You got some fan fiction waiting to be written there.
Yeah, so Ambassador Trentino is now playing this guy who's directing Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman to go after Nazis.
That's pretty cool. Never thought about it that way. That's a good double feature right there.
This is the kind of stuff that happens when you've seen the film 75, 80 times.
Certainly, certainly. All right, so my two cents on what the greatest gift is for Duck Soup. I think that as passe as it can sometimes be for a picture of 90-year vintage, this is just my opinion. I mean, there are some dated elements, as I've expressed. Duck Soup remains, for me, refreshingly contemporary, you know, in its irreverent attitude, its radical style, one in which I think structure is created from, ironically, chaos, from anarchy, from nonconformity. And to me, it's a work that dares you not to laugh or at least crack a smile, even if you're, you know, this sourpuss scoffer or a strict adherent of current day pop culture only. I think that Groucho's merciless put downs, they still land. Chico's ridiculous word salad squabbles, they continue to delight us. Harpo has this impish demeanor, this, you know, slapstick that doesn't date. If you surrender yourself to the mirthful magic of the Marx Brothers and appreciate how influential they've been to comedy across all media in the 20th and the 21st century, as I've tried to lay an argument for, I think it speaks for itself. And the best present that Duck Soup can give me or any of us is to remind us how classic comedy can transcend time, Robert, how endlessly entertaining and motivating it can be to new generations of comedians and filmmakers to look to the past for future comedic inspirations. But undoubtedly, if I were to name two greatest gifts, the second would be the mirror scene.
Hard to exclude that.
I mean, this is an all-time tour de force of film clownery, and it's only, I actually went back, rewatched it, timed it. It's 167 seconds, roughly 3 minutes, give or take. But it's been continually mirrored in its own way by, as we said, imitators, by admirers for nearly a century. I get that they didn't invent the mirror scene, but this is the one that's remembered. And I don't know if I've ever laughed harder, Robert, at a sequence than the second time I screened the mirror sequence. So I say a second time because my virgin viewing of Duck Soup, and again, it was probably around age 8, was spent mostly watching my stepdad, who has since passed away. My stepdad, he just loved comedies, and he's the guy who would just fall over, doubling over in rapturous laughter, and that laughter was contagious. He's that kind of a guy where you saw when he laughed, he would just absolutely crack you up, and you didn't even know him necessarily what he was laughing at. But I remember him watching Duck Soup, so I'm watching him more than I'm watching Duck Soup, and he's doubled over with laughter at, you know, the antics of the Marx Brothers, right? And he's shifting into this cacophonous guffaw mode once that mirror routine comes on screen. And that experience taught me that some comedic moments are on a higher plane than others. I mean, some scenes, jokes, images, they're so powerful that they can make your stomach sore from overlaughing. They can cause you to literally lose your breath, to moisten the corners of your eyes by being the complete opposite of sad. I still feel verklempt with laughter from the yucks that this mirror sequence elicits every time I watch it. And it's all the more impressive to learn in reading about it that I guess they shot that scene in only about 2 hours. Incredible.
There's a story that Groucho tells in the Marx Brothers scrapbook. Mm-hmm. They did it on a Saturday morning. Nobody else around the studio, director calling out stuff. There's no audio, obviously. And they had a limited amount of time to do it because according to Groucho in this very salty interview memoir, McCary had another appointment to go see, I believe, a woman for hire, shall we say.
Okay.
So McCary had other plans that afternoon. We had to do this quick because he had to go somewhere. And I'll just, if you go look in the March for the Scrapbook, you'll find out what Groucho said. I'm not going to tell you. But it's not clean. But what I'll say is the gifts of Duck Soup are endless for me. Every time I watch it, I find something else I love about it that I've always loved. One of the great unusual gifts of Duck Soup is Edgar Kennedy. The Marx Brothers allowing another comic to step in and work with them almost on equal footing and get his own laughs. And it's really rare because Edgar Kennedy is a super pro. And the bit,
he's the lemonade vendor, by the way.
Yes, he's the lemonade vendor. He's also the guy who comes home and finds Harpo in his bathtub. Edgar Kennedy is a great little moment or two in that film. And it's rare because you just don't see other established comics showing up in a Marx Brothers picture and doing such good work. To a small degree, you could give that to Thelma Todd, who was popular on her own, but she was really being a second banana. Edgar Kennedy's in there as a comedian doing his own thing.
Great stuff.
Which is really, really wonderful. And yeah, the thing about Duck Soup that always resonates for me each time I see it is how wonderful the musical numbers are.
True.
I can't get past those musical numbers.
Yeah, well said. So, Robert, are there any forthcoming projects, books, events, appearances our audiences would like to know more about? Now, you said that the next book is, can you repeat what it is?
Yeah, I've just about wrapped up a biography of Zeppo, which will be filled with information new to almost everyone.
Mm-hmm.
In the research for it, there was a ton of information that was new to me. And I've spent, you know, the better part of, 50 years or more researching the Marx Brothers for whatever reason I have to do that. I can't imagine why, but I've done it. And Zeppo has a very unusual story, and I hope this book will be out next year. Keep an eye out for it. In addition to that, I'll just recommend that if people have the ability to see my American Masters film, Groucho and Cavett, it's still running on stations around the country on American Masters. You can also see it on the PBS app.
When did that first debut? I just went one
December of last year, December of 22. Mm-hmm. It pops up on American Masters, and I know you can stream it on their app. And I think their app is basically free to PBS members, but I don't know how that works.
Okay.
So go to PBS.org and figure out how to watch Groucho and Cavett. It's a lot of fun. And I will also recommend, if people haven't seen my book, For the Three Musketeers, a revised paperback edition came out recently, about 6-7 months ago. And it's basically the same exact book in paperback. It's a big, heavy book, so the paperback lets you lift it a little bit easier. And most of the new material is confined to the lengthy stage chronology in the back of the book. A few little bits and pieces have worked themselves into the text, like I've been asked what's new in the new edition. I'll just throw out one story. The story of Mabel O'Donnell and the Three Nightingales gets a little bit of a revision through the courtesy of her granddaughter, who I was able to speak to after the book came out. So really happy to have that in there.
Fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Exciting things on the horizon, too, with that Zeppo book. And I just had a quick question here. So
sure.
If you go to marxbrothers.net, it says it's the official internet home of the Marx Brothers. And it does list your book and some other things you can check out. Are you affiliated with that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I'm trying to get it updated and do some new things with it. I've been sort of lax with it. I took it over a while back because it was kind of laying dormant. So I'm going to try and beef it up a little bit.
Fantastic. Robert, it was such a pleasure to talk to you and go deep in the weeds on all things Marx Brothers and Duck Soup.
It was great fun for me. And I'll see you in 2 years. We'll do this for a night at the opera.
All right, I'm already putting it down on my calendar.
All right, sounds good.
Thank you so much. Best of luck with your future endeavors. Can't wait to check out the Zeppo book.
All right, be well. Thank you.
Boy, oh boy, we sure got the Duck Soup to Nuts breakdown there from Robert, huh? That is a man in the know on all Marx matters, and we're so appreciative he was able to join us for this episode. Robert, thank you again. It's now time for Standing Ovations. This is the point in the program where I give a shout out to a film, book, website, event, TV program, or maybe another worthy item of interest to movie lovers just like you. So for August, I'm not going to designate a specific shout out to one thing. What I'm going to do is pay a little respect to several different movie milestone anniversaries that are being celebrated in the month of August. And we've got some big ones here, just in this month alone, so I'll just kind of go chronologically by date of release. So, for example, back on August 5th of 1953, movie theaters first debuted From Here to Eternity. That means it's marking a 70th birthday this month. Now, that was directed by Fred Zinnemann. Of course, you remember Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr and even Frank Sinatra in that film. Let's see, on August 5th, same date, it was the 35th birthday of a pretty good horror film remake, The Blob. This is directed by Chuck Russell, and it was a redo of the 1958 sci-fi horror film that, you know, depicted a small town terrorized by a gelatinous alien entity that consumes everything in its path. Not a bad little film. Check it out. Okay, on August 6th, that was the 30th birthday of The Fugitive, directed by Andrew Davis. Great film starring Harrison Ford that followed Dr. Richard Kimball as he evaded capture and sought to uncover the truth behind his wife's murder while being pursued by a relentless U.S. Marshal. All right, we had a big golden anniversary that just passed us last week, and it was American Graffiti, which was released originally on August 11th, 1973. Helmed by George Lucas, this was a great coming-of-age drama depicting a group of teenagers who spend a memorable night cruising the streets, experiencing various adventures in 1962 California. 35 years ago this month, to be specific, on August 12th, it was the release of The Last Temptation of Christ. This was the pet project of Martin Scorsese, a controversial work that explores the inner struggles of Christ as he grapples with his divine destiny and earthly desires. It's really worth checking out. Okay, we've got a trio of movie birthdays here to celebrate. First is Lord of the Flies, which was originally released on August 13th, 1963, directed by Peter Brook. Now, this is a really good adaptation of William Golding's novel. August 15th, 60 years ago, it was Billy Liar. This was a John Schlesinger production, a British comedy drama that follows a young man named Billy Fisher who daydreams to escape his dull reality. Exceptional work. Horror fans should take note that Black Sabbath, directed by the great Mario Bava, has its 60th birthday on August 17th, an Italian horror anthology. 25 years ago, it was Run Lola Run that hit theaters on August 20th, directed by Tom Tykwer. This German film presented three alternate scenarios in which a character named Lola must race against time to save her boyfriend from dire consequences. Very innovative film. Documentarian Errol Morris made his mark 35 years ago with The Thin Blue Line, released on August 25th of 1988. And then there are a pair of 75th anniversary movies worthy of celebration. On August 26th, it will be the 75th birthday of Howard Hawks' Red River, starring John Wayne and Montgomery Clift, and Alfred Hitchcock's Rope, featuring Jimmy Stewart, which first hit theaters on August 26th, 1948, proved to be quite an experimental and innovative film for the great master of suspense. And lastly, we have a 70th birthday coming up on August 27th. Back in 1953, it was Roman Holiday that hit theaters, directed by William Wyler and starring Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck. So hey, if nothing else, this list of birthday films will jog your memory and maybe encourage you to revisit some classics. Did you know that Cineversary has its own website? That's right, we actually now have a vanity URL that's easy to remember, which will take you to a freshly designed portal where you can quickly access the latest episode of your favorite podcast, as well as all of our previous installments. Now it's a lot easier to spread the good word about our show to your friends and family. You simply tell them to visit Cineversary.com. Pretty simple, right? That's Cineversary.com. We also have a custom email address just for you. Now, if you ever want to share feedback on our show or offer suggestions for future installments, or maybe you just have a question about Cineversary, send it to us at CineversaryPodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary show to your peeps. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us to get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, some of these other services, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that link, and leave a review and or rating. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook. We also have a presence on Twitter. Our handle is @CineversaryPod, where you can easily tweet or follow us. And if you want to go an extra step in your support of our show and help keep us ad-free, please consider making a monetary donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donatecineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, have you checked out my Cineverse Group website? Yeah, it's easy to get confused by these similar sounding names. Cineversary, Cineverse, Tomato, Tomato. But Cineverse is actually the name of my private film discussion group I founded back in 2005 that continues to meet weekly on Zoom. Every week, the Cineverse group watches, researches, and discusses a different movie, and I create a summary write-up, call it a mini-essay if you will, on that movie that gets posted to the Cineverse group blog. So if you want to enjoy reading in-depth content that examines different discussion-worthy motion pictures, including classic Hollywood films, independent features, foreign masterworks, modern movies, and silent-era standouts, then visit CineverseGroup.com, simply spelled C-I-N-E-V-E-R-S-E group.com. Fun fact, every posted article on CineverseGroup.com includes a link to a recording of our group discussion of that particular film, with me leading the conversation as moderator. So if you like what I'm doing on the Cineversary podcast, you might also want to give a listen to some of our Cineverse group recordings, which are podcasts of a different sort. Again, head over to CineverseGroup.com, where you can check out some interesting text and audio content on a variety of films, not necessarily celebrating a milestone anniversary. What we got lined up for September, you ask? Well, truth is, I've got two different roads we can take. But I'm waiting for confirmation from one of my guests before I can officially announce which path we will pursue and, yep, what the next Cineversary milestone movie will be. So I'm hoping this guest will say yes, but if not, we'll just take door number two, which is an equally worthy choice, trust me. So I guess I'll have to keep you in suspense until next time. My apologies, but we'll see y'all back in 1 month. Until then, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies. They are not getting older. They're getting Marxier.
The last man nearly ruined this place. He didn't know what to do with it. If you think this country's bad off, now just wait till I get through with it.
Thanks for giving us a listen.